Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're looking at a life story that's, well, pretty extraordinary. It's a real testament to resilience, finding your way.
Absolutely. We've got this incredible oral history, a veteran's firsthand account. It covers everything: war, hardship, some really surprising twists, and ultimately self-discovery.
And it's not just dry facts, right? This is from an audio recording, so you get the raw emotion, the wisdom he picked up along the way. Our job today is really to pull out those insights that maybe speak to all of us, you know?
Exactly. The source itself, it's mostly from a speech he gave. And it's full of humor, some incredibly moving memories, and he's surprisingly open about things.
Yeah, he even jokes about having, what was it, 21 pages of notes?
21 pages. And said he only cut out the thank you for listening part. So you know right away this is going to be quite personal and detailed.
It really sets the tone. So for you listening, this is a chance to see how, well, how tough beginnings can build character, how discipline can actually be a force for change, and how finding what you're meant to do can lead to amazing things, even when history is unfolding dramatically around you.
Couldn't have put it better. It's quite a ride.
Okay, so let's dive in. His childhood, it sounds like it was really marked by hardship.
Yeah. Definitely. Mm-hmm. He grew up with an alcoholic father, which is, you know, tough in itself. And then the family lost their ranch.
Right. The 360-acre ranch they'd built up since 1910 lost it because of the depression, bad weather, and a bank failure in Glasgow, Montana. Just devastating.
A real perfect storm of external factors hitting one family. And school wasn't much easier for him.
No, he mentioned being called a hick because his mom made bread instead of buying it. Can you imagine?
It sounds trivial now, maybe, yeah. But back then. And it led to him fighting back. He got labeled a ruffian, a no-good teenager.
And he internalized that, felt he was dumber than others, not worth anyone's time.
Mm-hmm. Just carried that weight. But then something shifted.
Yeah, this is where it gets interesting. His football coach. An unexpected figure.
Right. The coach would actually meet him at the school gate, ask if he'd eaten, and if not, take him home and feed him. He used the term nursemaided, like providing that steady care.
That one person, that consistent positive influence, it started to pave a different path for him, didn't it? Really influenced his later career choice, too.
Absolutely. It shows how much impact one person can have, even when everything else feels negative.
Yeah.
But it was actually a specific incident that pushed him towards the military.
Oh, yeah, the biology class story with Elsie Whiff.
That's the one. He and another kid clapped when she opened her book, trying to one-up each other and being disruptive, it sounds like.
And boom, threat of expulsion.
Right. And that led him to Judge Hurley, a WWI vet who'd been gassed. The judge's advice was pretty blunt. He said, 2 years inform you a bit of good.
And he did it. He enlisted. But military life hit him like a ton of bricks right away.
Oh, immediately. Arriving in San Diego, the story about forming the platoon by height.
Hilarious, but painful. He totally misunderstood the corporal, just picked a spot to get away quick.
And landed himself 20 days in the brig, on bread and water.
He said that was the first time, the absolute first time, he experienced real discipline.
Yeah, inescapable discipline. For a kid who felt like a ruffian, that kind of harsh structure was maybe the first step towards changing how he saw himself, even if it was brutal.
Then came boot camp under Sergeant Ostrander, or Orander, he wasn't sure on the name.
Right, the guy who said, send your heart home to your mother because your rear end belongs to me for the next 12 weeks. Classic drill sergeant talk, but intense, designed to break you down.
To rebuild you, and for him it worked. That graduation moment, that was huge for him.
It really was, getting his envelope, shaking the sergeant's hand, and just bawling, as he put it, crying.
Because it was the first time he felt he'd actually succeeded at something. He said it changed his life completely.
That feeling of accomplishment, after years of feeling like nothing, you can see how profound that would be. It redefined him.
And the Marines gave him a whole new language too, didn't they? Part of that total immersion.
Yeah, rope became line, steps were ladders, cigarettes butts.
Candy was pokey bait. Beer with slush. Every little detail reinforces the identity.
Exactly. Stripping away the old, building the new, and that new identity was immediately tested. Iwo Jima.
God, Iwo Jima. The scale of it is just hard to comprehend. 36 days.
7,000 Americans killed, 14,000 wounded or missing. Just staggering numbers. You really have to pause and think about the human cost.
And for him, it became intensely personal very quickly.
Yeah. His radio man, Jack Coleman, he called him his soulmate. Killed by a mortar shell right next to him.
He described it so brutally. A bunch of meat and some bones and dog tags. And then he just blacked out.
The trauma. Losing someone that close in that way, it underscores those incredibly deep bonds formed under fire and the sheer psychological horror of it all.
The landing itself sounds like pure chaos.
He said it was like landing in a rainstorm, but every drop was a piece of rifle. He got hit too, took three pieces in his back.
But even then, his resourcefulness, they couldn't land properly.
Right. So he and Jack, they borrowed a rubber boat from an LST.
A landing ship tank, yep.
Paddled it around to the back of Mount Suribachi, climbed up, and actually cleared out a Japanese observation post. Three soldiers there, then set up their own OP.
Just incredible ingenuity under fire, pure survival instinct and training kicking in.
And that's where he was when the famous flag raising happened.
Right. He heard English, saw this kid raise a small flag first, then the ship started honking, artillery firing.
And then the Japanese joined in, firing back. Suddenly, their relatively safe spot wasn't safe at all. It became a target.
Imagine witnessing that iconic moment, but your immediate reality is just increased danger.
Wow. The journey home wasn't exactly smooth sailing either.
No kidding. Waking up on an AKA, an attack cargo ship.
And sailing right into the tail end of a typhoon off Saipan. 40-foot waves crashing over the bow, the whole ship shimmying.
From combat horror to the sheer power of nature. Just relentless.
Then came the news. The atomic bombs. War's over. The 4th Marine Division disbanded.
He had 4 months left, wanted to go to Folsom, near his home in Deer Park, Washington. Makes sense.
But nope. Orders came through. Camp Lejeune, North Carolina.
As he put it, typical Marine Corps. They wanted to make sure I got to farther away from where I wanted to be.
Huh. Yeah, that sounds about right. The needs of the Corps. But the journey there, the transfer in Chicago, that's another story.
Oh, that was wild. Walking between stations, sees a guy bleeding. Been jackpulled.
Which sounds like mugged or beaten up.
Yeah. And then the taxi driver takes him all over the place.
30 different places, he said. Charges him $26 for what should have been a 25-cent bus ride.
It just highlights how jarring that return to civilian life could be, right? The world kept moving, and maybe not always in honest ways.
Definitely a disconnect. But then at Camp Lejeune, he gets this duty he actually enjoys.
Yeah, as a corporal, he's mustering second lieutenants, taking charge.
And getting done by 8 a.m. most days. Left him time to explore, go to Charlotte, Raleigh, D.C.
And Louisiana for that friend's restaurant with the marvelous shrimp sauce he mentioned.
Finding little pockets of enjoyment. But then another seemingly random encounter changes things again.
Lieutenant Commander Jeremiah DeMorton at Cherry Point.
Yeah, the commander just recognizes him, asks if he wants to go home. Simple as that.
And of course he says yes. Next morning, he's got his discharge papers.
And his mustering out pay. 5 cents a mile, Camp Lejeune to Montana.
Yeah.
Over $500 plus combat pay. A decent sum back then.
Then there was that terrifying plane ride from Cherry Point to Minneapolis.
Oh, yeah. The pilot trying to take the top of every tree off. Sounds like a white-knuckle flight.
So he finally makes it home. But the story's far from over.
Not at all. Some of the most transformative parts are just starting. He meets Evelyn.
Right. Back in Deer Park at a drugstore. And it was instant.
Pretty much. He walks up, asks, what are you doing tonight? Apparently scares off the guy she was with.
Huh. And invites her to a barn dance, but only if you behave yourself. The confidence.
Amazing, isn't it? And he tells her right then, they're going to get married, have a batch of kids.
Her response was perfect. When pigs fly.
But 3 months later, January 26th,
yeah,
they were married.
Incredible. But she had a condition.
Mm-hmm. You had to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
Despite, you know, the 0.9 high school GPA being kicked out, her belief was key.
So how does that happen? How do you get into college like that?
Well, here's another twist. Remember the football coach, the one who nursemaided him?
Yeah.
He was now the head coach at Eastern Washington College. He found our guy, told him to come play ball, said, don't worry about the diploma, got him in.
Wow. That connection again, that mentorship paying off years later, it just shows you those relationships matter.
Absolutely. And he didn't just squeak by in college. He excelled.
Yeah. Made the traveling squad, starting wide receiver, led the nation in receiving his junior year.
Unanimously all conference. It's an incredible turnaround. Shows what happens when discipline meets opportunity and someone believes in you.
And then he gets an offer from Vince Lombardi, Green Bay Packers.
Yep. A tryout, $500. This is pre-Dynasty Lombardi, but still.
But he turned it down.
He did. He had a job by then, Evelyn, a baby on the way. He chose that life. Said later he probably avoided a lot of physical pain by not playing Pro Bowl.
That's perspective. Success isn't always the big leagues, right? It's about what aligns with your life, your values.
Exactly. and he took that drive into coaching himself in Chelan.
Three seasons, only lost three games, won three championships, and sent a lot of his players to four-year colleges.
Passing on that mentorship, that belief, completing the circle.
Then he moved to Central Valley High School, taught history, psychology, started the counseling department.
And this seems like where he really found his calling, connecting with the tough kids.
He said he saw himself in them. That was me sitting there.
Helping them, he realized he wasn't an oddball. It's just a normal kid who'd had a rough start. That self-acceptance found through helping others.
That's powerful.
Yeah.
And family life continued. There was that funny story about his son Steve's birth.
Oh, the jockstrap tradition. Started by John Simchuk from the athletic store. A jockstrap with a football in the baby's crib.
And he kept it going for his grandson. Just a quirky, sweet detail about his life.
He spent 27 years at Central Valley. Became an assistant principal for 1,600 kids.
And was known for just having this great rapport, always something jovial to say. You can see how his own journey would make him connect with students.
Definitely. His graduation speech when he was 81, that sounds like it was quite a moment.
Started crying, but got a standing ovation from 3,000 parents. Just pure gratitude, it seems.
A life well lived, impacting others. But then life throws another curveball.
Yeah. Just 2 weeks after he retired, Evelyn was diagnosed with cancer.
3 years of what he called hell. 9 surgeries, chemo, another immense battle, just a different kind.
Bringing it back to the war for a moment, that return trip to Iwo Jima in 95 sounds incredibly significant.
Hugely. He was pretty dismissive of the Hollywood version, the John Wayne movie, Sands of Iwo Jima. Called it Hollywood ice, no sense.
Because he knew the reality. And going back, seeing his old foxhole on Suribachi from the plane.
And the ceremony itself, on Japanese soil now, with Japanese attendees, even two former POWs.
The American flag only flying one day a year there, that really speaks volumes about the history, the respect.
But the most intense moment for him seems to have been sitting on that beach where Jack was killed.
Just bawling again. Uncontrollably. And the chaplain's words.
If you think about this, remember it, because someday you remember anything. Think about this. Almost like embrace this grief, this memory. It's part of you.
That grief lingered, clearly. Years later, he finally decided to visit Jack Coleman's father down in Nevada, Oklahoma.
And that sounds like it was incredibly cathartic. They drank beer, cried, laughed, even lied to one another. Maybe sharing comforting stories or just connecting in their shared loss.
He said it lifted another load off my shoulders, that need to connect to share the story even decades later. It's profound.
The memory of Jack, his soulmate, never left him. And his perspective on the island itself, still the farm kid.
Right. Looking at the volcanic sand and thinking, you can't raise anything on this. A practical, almost heartbreaking observation about a place defined by death.
And apparently, according to his son, he didn't really start talking about these experiences until after that 50th anniversary trip back.
It unlocked something, which is why saving these stories is so important, like Richard LaFrancis from the Pappy Boyington Museum said.
Exactly. So kids, future generations know about it. So maybe, just maybe, history doesn't repeat itself in the same way.
There was that little anecdote, too, about the young sailor illegally grabbing artifacts, sand, souvenirs from Iwo Jima. Shows how that place still holds such power, such fascination.
Definitely. But ultimately, his big life lesson, the thing that shifted everything for him, came from advice from an older guy.
Right. Basically saying, look, despite everything, you've had a good life. 2 wonderful women, 9 wonderful kids, lots of grandbabies.
And that just clicked for him, changed his whole perspective. He started waking up with gratitude.
Oh, thank you for the day. What do you got in store for me today? And he found that approach led to, well, amazing things. Opportunities to help others, like that caretaker.
And that final realization. I wasn't an oddball. I was just a normal kid. Coming full circle from feeling dumber and no good to complete self-acceptance and purpose. What a journey.
It really is. From that 0.9 GPA ruffian to this respected educator, fulfilled family man. It just shows you, doesn't it, the power of resilience. Finding paths you never expected.
And the impact of mentorship. Discipline, sometimes coming from really unexpected places like a drill sergeant or a caring coach.
It's about overcoming huge adversity, learning those lessons, and really transforming how you see yourself. For you listening, there's so much here.
Yeah, think about those tough moments in your own life. The times you felt, I don't know, jackpulled in Chicago, metaphorically speaking, or stuck in your own kind of brig.
How do those moments, those really defining, often difficult times, actually shape who you become? How can they lead to triumphs you didn't expect if you let yourself, you know, learn and grow from them?
It's a good question to reflect on. Understanding journeys like this one, it can really offer a fresh perspective on our own lives and maybe the lives of people around us too.